The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light."
What I'm going to try to do here today is just show you Bible teachings that are unpopular, that people don't like, or they don't know about.
Keeper of the ancient mysteries, guardian of the ancient secrets. The Sphinx is considered to be the greatest statue on earth.
Every 100 years or so, an idea comes along that can shake the world. An idea so revolutionary that at first no one believes it could be true.
The magician will now attempt a dangerous trick that's not for the faint of heart or stomach. He's about to give himself a trendy body piercing the hard way. By the way, don't try this one at home.
The Book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Four hundred years ago, Galileo argued that the Bible was to be read allegorically. Its purpose was to teach us the way to go to heaven, not the way the heavens go. Scroll forward to the 18th century and we find the Scottish philosopher David Hume dismissing the Bible as a book presented to us by a barbarous and ignorant people, corroborated by no concurring testimony. So why, at the dawn of the 21st century, has one of our leading writers on genetics devoted himself to a book investigating the Bible's scientific credentials? For Steve Jones, the Bible sits firmly in the genealogy of ideas, and science is its direct descendant. He goes so far as to say that Genesis was the world's first biology textbook. Steve joins us here in the studio along with Peter Lamont, an Edinburgh-based psychology lecturer and one-time professional magician, whose new book, Extraordinary Beliefs, A Historical Approach to a Psychological Problem, looks for explanations for all sorts of apparent paranormal phenomena, from mind reading to psychokinesis, that's Uri Geller to you and me, in their historical and social contexts. He joins us down the line from Scotland. Welcome to both of you. Now, since both these books are too recent for many of our readers to have had a chance to read for themselves, or even for you to have read each other's, could you begin by each giving us a potted synopsis of what you're up to? Steve, The Serpent's Promise. It's what's known as a trade book, i.e. designed for the general public rather than for a specialist readership, isn't it?
Oh, yes, most definitely. As I often say, I don't mind if its creationist readers burn it as long as they buy it first. My book is fundamentally a science book, and this is what I try to make clear from the very beginning. It's not a book about theology, it's not a book about religion. Most of all, it's not an attack on religion or, for that matter, a justification for religion. I kind of see myself as exploring what might be called Dawkins Canyon, which is the enormous gap, the chasm, between books like The God Delusion, which attack with great virulence the notion of religious thought, and the much feebler collection of works that attempt to defend it. And I don't think science has really got much of a place in that argument, because religion and science are not the same thing. Science can tell us things with some certainty, although never with absolute certainty. Religion can assert things which cannot directly be tested. So my notion was to take the Bible, which is a number of different things. It's a great work of art, for a start. There's no question of that in the King James translation. It's a work of history, some of which has got evidence, some of which doesn't. It's a work of the rule of law, of how you should behave yourself in society. It's a work for some people, and not for me as an atheist, which ties them to a mythical and imagined future through the ultimate sacrifice of a divine altruist, and I accept all this as being part of the Bible. But to me, it is also absolutely, in both Old and New Testaments, an attempt by the people of those days to understand the world around them. Where did the universe come from? Why are there males and females? Are we born with an inborn fate, or can we change our fate? Why are we so nice to each other? Do unto others as we would like to have them do unto us. And all these are closely related to the kinds of questions asked by scientists. And that's what I try and do. I ask those larger questions in a biblical context and in what I liked to think, and I emphasize the past tense, I liked to think was a coherent account of some of the themes within the Bible. I have to say, most Bible scholars vehemently disagree with me.
The structure of the book is that you pick themes. So, for example, you have a chapter called Methuselah about aging. I'm intrigued by Zwingli's sausages, which is about food in the Bible.
Yeah, it's about identity, that chapter. It's a really bizarre thing. I enjoy writing this book because there's so much madness around this, it's hard to believe. It turns out that all religions, all societies, define themselves, their identity, their shared togetherness, in many ways, one of which almost invariably is by the food they eat. Some foods are forbidden, some foods are welcomed. And of course, in Judaism, going to Leviticus, there's page after page after page about what you can and what you cannot eat. And that goes on into Christianity, the Catholic Mass, which sees the transubstantiation of bread and wine into the flesh and blood of Jesus. That played an important part in the Reformation. At the time of the Reformation, the Catholic Church was bloated, I think is the right word. It had a rich and intellectually, if not physically, corrupt priesthood. It had large numbers of adherents who were forced to pay great sums of money and follow strict rules, but the priests didn't play a part. They would eat on fast days and so on. And the various reformers, one of whom was the Swiss Zwingli, his gesture against the Catholic Church was on a fasting day to cut up several large sausages and distribute them among his fellow worshippers. And this led to complete outrage. But it reminds us of the way we bind ourselves together with fundamentally absurd customs. What you eat being one of them, what you wear being another one. It ties into a large part of the Old Testament theme of, in my ignorant view, we're Jews, you get lost. Now, in other words, this is God's chosen people, and this is how we define ourselves as different from everybody else. That desire to define yourself as different, and perhaps even superior, is part of every religion, possibly every society.
Peter, coming to you, Extraordinary Beliefs is a very different sort of book. It's an academic publication from Cambridge University Press, which inducted me into conjuring theory, frame analysis, and discourse analysis, while actually telling a fascinating story very well about what one might call bewitchment through the ages.
I've been in the world of parapsychology for a long time. As a sceptic, I don't believe in the paranormal, but I know plenty of people who do. And I don't buy the rather simplistic argument that belief in the paranormal is simply due to stupidity or gullibility. So I want to step back from the problem and, as a historian, look at the question, why belief in the paranormal? And the first thing you need to do is realize that there's more than one kind of belief. People believe in the paranormal, but people also believe the opposite. People believe that there's no such thing. And so really the appropriate question is not why do people believe in the paranormal, but how do people come to the conclusions that they do? So even though I don't believe in the paranormal, I don't begin to study beliefs in the paranormal by assuming that they're wrong. I don't think that's a useful way to start.
You make the claim that it shows how in constructing and maintaining particular beliefs about particular phenomena, we've been in the business of constructing ourselves.
In recent years, there's a large sceptical movement associated more recently with the so-called New Atheism and so on. But it came out of an anti-paranormal position that belief in the paranormal is not only wrong, it's also a bad thing. Now, in making that argument, people are able to say, look, I'm not only right, I'm also doing the right thing, the good thing. So independent of the actual reality of things, by making these arguments, people are able to construct themselves in a particular way.
Let's look now at the way you structure your book. You structure it also thematically, but following a roughly historic line. I was really fascinated by the mesmerist chapter. Tell us a bit about mesmerism.
Mesmerism is named after Franz Mesmer, of course, who he called it animal magnetism. And although it's often seen as a late 18th century development, it's got links in all sorts of cultures and elsewhere. And you'll still see people who will claim that they can heal others by through some energy or chi or whatever. So it's not a unique thing, but certainly in late 18th, early 19th century Europe and America, it was quite a big thing. And what would happen is that people would go out, so mesmerists would go out and talk to the public. This was like early popular science. People went out and they would give talks, they would give demonstrations.
A bit like the author tour these days.
Yes, and they would give demonstrations of mesmeric phenomena. This would be very similar to much later stage hypnosis. So somebody is brought up, they are put in a trance, in a mesmeric state, and in this trance they are unable to feel pain or they act out in rather strange ways, and often they display clairvoyant abilities. And so they'd be blindfolded, for example, and they would display the ability to see without using their eyes. So people would see this and they would think, well, that appears to be real, and they would believe in the phenomena. And so one of the reasons why people believe in these things is that they see things and they don't know how else to explain them.
So on the cover of your book, you have a rather remarkable picture of two mesmerists holding a woman who's in a Grecian robe, absolutely flat as a plank, held at feet and neck by two men.
It's actually a mesmerised subject being in a cataleptic state. So it's one of the common things that mesmerists would do. They would perhaps put an arm, in this case the whole body, into a cataleptic state through, allegedly, this animal magnetism. And they would become stiff, and then that stiffness, people would come up and try and bend the arm. So what happened probably around this time was that James Braid came up with a different interpretation of the evidence. So one of the things is that people see these things and they're told it's due to a mesmeric state and due to animal magnetism, which is like an invisible fluid or energy. But then James Braid says, no, it's not. It's actually due to what becomes later hypnosis.
I would imagine that this is some sort of illusion, this particular picture. But on the other hand, you have anecdotes of people who did undergo limb amputations in a mesmerised state without anaesthetic or anything, without
right,
apparently
yes.
feeling any pain.
Yes, and there are several more recent reports too about people undergoing things that should surely be painful, but apparently in this trance state, they are not painful. You had operations being carried out in Europe, also in India, with teeth being extracted. That was a common thing. One of the common services that mesmerists would offer to dental surgeons was the ability to put patients into a trance so they wouldn't feel the pain whilst having teeth extracted, which in itself was a very practical and useful thing. Now, there are at least three different ways you can believe in these things. You can believe that they're real, so it's not a trick, it's not chance. You can believe it's due to a particular force, like mesmeric or psychic, and you can believe that this particular force is incompatible or not in line with science, which is the strict definition of the word paranormal.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some real overlap with science there, which I'm sure you're aware of. Oddly enough, when I was a student in Edinburgh in the 1960s, we were lectured in some technical aspect of genetics by a guy called David Wood Gush. But he'd lecture away, and every now and again, he'd grimace with pain and take out a little buzzing box from his pocket and apply it to the stump of his left arm, because he'd been in the Second World War and his hand had been shot off. Okay, and he had phantom limb pain, which, as you're well aware, is a real problem. If you lose a limb, sometimes you imagine the limb is still there. Your hand, for example, seems to clench itself painfully and you can't force it to open. And it's a classic, really, of how in brain science the obvious is nearly always wrong, because the little buzzing box that he had turned on the notion that there were what were called pain gates in the nervous system, whereby putting this buzzer on your arm, you would fool the nervous system into thinking your hand was actually there. That turned out to be complete fantasy. There's no evidence at all that that's true.
Is that not related to the TENS machine, which I was given when I was having my baby?
It's not unrelated. It comes from the same theory. Then surgeons being by definition psychopaths to a man, what a lot of them did would say, oh, you've got this terrible pain in the end of the stump of your arm. We'll take a bit more off to get rid of the pain. And so they start chopping more and more of your arm off, which is completely absurd. But then there turned out this astonishing illusion, the mirror illusion, where what you do, you have somebody with astonishing difficult pain in their missing left hand and a working right hand. They feel the missing left hand is clenched intolerably. They can do nothing about it. You give them a mirror, which they hold at an angle. They look at their existing right hand and at its reflection in the mirror, which they place where the left hand ought to be. They open the right hand and the pain in the non-existent left hand goes away. And that's a physiologically powerful and effective means of treatment for phantom limb pain, which is almost like magic. And of course, an awful lot of science is almost like magic, but only because we don't understand how it works.
The people who went, for example, to a mesmerist when they were getting their teeth extracted, they didn't really care that much how it worked. They just wanted the pain not to be there. And so the idea that these things work is one way in which people think, so it's real then. Whereas, and this is I think what Steve was getting at, that beyond that there's something else, which is what's actually going on? What's the explanation for it? And for many people, that's not the thing that matters. What matters to them is simply, does it work or not?
There's a lovely quote from William James, who you both cite in your books, and he says, "An hallucination is a strictly sensational form of consciousness, as good and true a sensation as if there were a real object there. The object happens not to be there, that is all."
James's place as the father of American psychology was extremely important in debates about what were then psychic phenomena, because James, of course, was the most famous and most senior psychologist in America, and yet, of course, he was interested in spiritualism and psychical research and did believe that many psychic phenomena were genuine, which annoyed many of his colleagues. And there were lots of arguments about this.
He's a fascinating bloke. He gave a series of lectures in New College, Edinburgh, which, as you will know, is a building of unremitting grimness. He was an experimental psychologist. He was very much involved in drugs. And I have a chapter in my book about the various hallucinations and images and fantasies that people in various faiths have experienced, and to them are no doubt are very real. And William James was a great devotee of laughing gas. It was the key to the universe. It seems absurd. I mean, I think most of us have tried sniffing laughing gas now and again. I certainly have. It really did open the doors of perception to him. He made some really bizarre notes. What is nausea but a kind of ausia? He also tried Mexican cacti like peyote, and he didn't like that. It made him vomit, and that gave me a certain wry satisfaction, because in the early 1970s, when I lived in the States, which is a very druggy time, I remember being up in the Rocky Mountains collecting the world's highest fruit fly, which I have to tell you I succeeded in trapping at great personal risk, and was surrounded by hippies who'd built themselves geodesic domes. And I remember going to one of these geodesic domes and ingesting some of this stuff and being surrounded by people who were on the road to the transcendental. I just felt seasick. And I kind of wonder whether how many of those 1970s hippies have become born-again Christians. I would think a lot.
Some of these experiments have been restaged, particularly in the 70s, under controlled scientific conditions, haven't they?
Yes, there was the famous Marsh Chapel experiment in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where a congregation was given large doses of LSD, or mescaline, which is related to LSD, and asked what it did to their feelings of faith. And they came out with astonishing statements that God was in heaven, the world was filled with golden rays of light, I have become a much better person than before I took this drug. And I just find that startling, but I think it shows the ability of many people, perhaps people of faith more than most, to fool themselves that things are happening when they're not there.
Since we're on the 1970s, you deal quite a lot with Uri Geller, Peter. I remember seeing him bending spoons on television. I know that's true course. I saw it with my own eyes.
There you go. Everyone knows that he bends spoons. The argument is about how does he do it. So the argument is not about hallucination in this case, that many paranormal phenomena might be explained according to hallucination. It might be explained according to neural processes and so on. But in many other cases, and Geller would be one example, it's not about that. Something is happening in the real world. We can see it with our own eyes, and we then have to decide what to do with it. And if you choose to say it's not trickery, then you end up in a position of believing that it's psychokinesis, for example. So the question then is, well, how do you know if it's trickery or not? Maybe you know how it's done. The explanations are out there. They've been out there for a long time. So I know all the explanations. I've bent a few spoons myself. Some of my best friends have bent spoons, and have met Geller and seen him bend spoons and have come away saying, I'm not actually sure how he did it. So at that point, you have a gap again. Does that mean that it's psychokinesis, or does it mean it's an unexplained trick? And that's one of the forks in the road that we have to choose in order to decide whether or not we believe or not.
You have a chapter on miracles, of course, the colour of the crystal.
It's not really about miracles. It's about illusions, beliefs and that kind of stuff.
Yes, which not, has an absolute overlap with Petersburg.
One of the things which I've been much criticised about, and I feel justified by, I don't talk at all about things which are simply not open to scientific discussion. Things like walking on the water, shall we say, or turning water into wine, I mean, or even coming back from the dead. There are no scientific depths, if that's the word, to be explored there. So I don't talk about these mystical issues at all. I talk about much more concrete issues. But there are issues about delusions and illusions which are strongly related to brain science and, of course, to conjuring and things of that nature.
And Peter, you make the point that a lot of the early scientists believed in miracles.
It's a reminder when you think of, say, Isaac Newton or Robert Boyle. Newton studied alchemy, Boyle believed in second sight. We'd now call them creationists in the sense that they both believed that the world was created around 4000 BC. That, of course, was the time and place, and many people would say if Newton was alive today, he wouldn't believe that now. Even when people like Michael Faraday were railing against magic and superstition, Faraday was what we'd now call a fundamentalist Christian. People are very much products of their time, and sometimes when the history of science is written, we have this idea that these heroes of science are in our own image today, when, of course, that's not the case. They were very much products of their own time.
Newton's a classic example. He was much more interested in what he called the book of God's words, which is the Bible, than the book of God's works, which is the universe. He was convinced that the universe was the way it was because this was evidence of the fact that God had put it into being and started it all off. It's impenetrable. He has hundreds of pages investigating the very important scientific question that on the Day of Judgment, on the apocalypse, how many whores of Babylon are there going to be? Is it going to be 1, 100, 1,000? And this year, as of course everybody knows, is the centennial of the death of Alfred Russel Wallace, who died in 1913, a convinced spiritualist. And nothing that Darwin, who was a rationalist of the purest kind, could persuade him that spiritualism, there was something separate, the world of the spirit. He could speak from beyond the grave to the beyond the grave, and we should speak back to him. And he could not be persuaded of anything else.
They believed in these things because of this so-called crisis of faith. So the basic story is that thanks to developments in geology, in other forms of science, biblical criticism, and of course evolutionary theory, and most famously Darwin and to some extent Wallace, religion, biblical truth are challenged. And so, in a bid to hang on to faith, people reach for evidence-based faith, which is what spiritualism was intended to be. It was based almost entirely upon the phenomena of the seance, and that was seen as evidence of an afterlife. It's been a common argument, but actually I think it's far too simplistic. And one of the reasons is that many, many people believed the phenomena were real, but didn't believe that they were supernatural.
And you also talk about the fascination with visual illusion. Kaleidoscopes were invented at that time, and stroboscopes.
There's a lot of interest and development in optical illusions, and there's growing discussion of the unreliability of the senses, and all this links up with doubts about miracles and so on, and of course the growth of conjuring, so that by which I mean what we'd now call magic in the kind of David Copperfield style. So certainly there's a growing awareness amongst the Victorians that you can't necessarily believe your eyes. And so this feeds into this debate about what become known as psychic phenomena, that, well, can you trust the senses and can you trust testimony and memory and what about trickery and so on?
I mean, one of the striking things in the context of interpreting these phenomena, often in religious terms, is how similar the visions and imaginations of different peoples across the globe actually are. And the thing which really startled me in the literature on this was the writings and sketches of Hildegard of Bingen, who was, of course, a famous composer and also a mystic. And she drew pictures of shooting stars and of pulsating battlements, visions of battlements, which she described as having seen starkly in front of her own eyes, guarding the world of God. And it transpires that actually that almost certainly is due to something which I very slightly suffer from, which is a migraine. And people with migraines, and about one person in five has them at some time or another, frequently have this feeling in front of their eyes of what's called a scotoma, a bright spot which is circling and jagged and sometimes blocks out the view. And I occasionally get that. And there's a phenomenon called Lewis Carroll syndrome, which makes it absolutely clear that Lewis Carroll had exactly this. And that, in fact, Alice in Wonderland is almost entirely an account of a migraine attack. People with a severe form of this syndrome, imagine, for example, that they're falling down a dark hole into light, just as in the rabbit hole. They think that they're becoming enormous or very small, just like Alice. They think their limbs are stretching or contracting, like Alice's neck. Now, the Cheshire Cat, it seems very likely, and its author describes in his own diary, I saw that strange illusion of a man with his hand raised and his hand disappeared. That was the cat. The cat disappeared and the smile was left. It was incidentally also sparked off by eating mushrooms with caterpillars on top, no doubt. So you can actually make a scientific or a quasi-scientific explanation of where these visions come from. What these visions mean to those who experience them, I think, is a totally different thing, and it may well be that science cannot answer that.
I just want to leave with one last thing which amused me greatly in your book, Steve, which was your story about Genesis being the world's first biology textbook. And I was thinking about that and thinking about the fact that we no longer believe in Adam and Eve. But what modern science has taught us is that there was a common ancestor who we know of as Eve.
And indeed of Adam. That isn't science, that's arithmetic. You've got two parents. Each of those had two parents. Each of those had two parents. And if you start doing that 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64 number, okay, it's clear that within a few centuries you would have a population on the Earth of hundreds of billions, which you simply don't have. Okay, what that means is that in the end we're all forced to share ancestors because there aren't enough ancestors to go around. The average Briton, if you're on a bus in Edinburgh, shall we say, and sitting next to another Scot, on average the two individuals there who simply probably don't know each other, on average they're sixth cousins. They have a common ancestor who lived probably at some time in the 19th century. On average, everybody in the world descends from somebody who lived, embarrassingly enough, at about Archbishop Usher's time, 4004 BC. We do have a shared ancestor there. Now, that's going through both males and females. But if you go through males, Y chromosomes, and through females, mitochondria, which are passed from mothers to sons and daughters, but only daughters pass them on, you converge on this individual who's known as Luca, the last universal common ancestor, who's bound to be there. There's bound to be an Adam and there's bound to be an Eve. But the interesting thing is they never met, let alone commit the first and perhaps least original of all sins, which is what the serpent's promise persuaded them to do, because Adam lived about 100,000 years ago, Eve about 200,000 years ago. That's not in the Bible.
And just imagine what delicious foods they wouldn't have, because, of course, one of the things in the Bible is there was no feasting before the exit from Eden.
I think there's something else you can get from Genesis by analogy, which is if you read the first few books, despite all the miracles, despite the creation of Adam and Eve and the plagues of small unpleasant creatures and the burning bush and so on, nobody actually expresses any wonder at any of it. And I think that kind of reflects the way we are, that in the beginning, if you'll pardon the pun, we don't know how the world works. So we can live in a world which is full of wonder, but we can't actually appreciate that anything's extraordinary until we've learned that some things shouldn't happen. And until we actually know what the rules are, until we know what's ordinary, what's normal, we don't know what's extraordinary or what's paranormal. And one of the reasons why, at different times and different places, people believe in strange things is because they have a different sense of normality, a different sense of the ordinary.
Two scientists there debating different forms of wonder. I'm only sorry Peter couldn't use his talents down the line from Edinburgh to bend some spoons in our studio. Steve Jones' The Serpent's Promise is published by Little Brown, and Peter Lamont's Extraordinary Beliefs by Cambridge University Press. Steve says he's already suffering from abuse from both believers and atheists for bending the evidence against them. So bear that in mind if you want to join the conversation on the page below our podcast. If you've come to us through iTunes or SoundCloud, you can find that by going to guardian.co.uk/books and clicking onto the podcast tab at the top of the site. And that's all from us for this week, apart from my customary exhortation to become a regular subscriber so you can catch our podcast without fail every week, as well as the occasional extras we run in between. One of those is coming up this very next week, when we'll be hearing from the antiquarian bookseller Rick Jakovsky about a charity sale of annotated books by famous authors to raise money for the writers' charity PEN. There'll be more on that in Guardian Review and on the website as well over the weekend. Until then, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardian audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening to them wherever you are, whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.